Welcome to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, where we explore the leadership journeys facing life science entrepreneurs. I'm David Kirk, and in each episode, I sit down with a life science leader to uncover the moments that define their leadership. My guest this week.
Hi, Dave. I'm James, CEO of LabGenius Therapeutics. At LabGenius, we combine high-throughput experimentation with machine learning to advance the next generation of complex therapeutic antibodies.
We're grateful at LifeScience.org to have a community of over 400 life science CEOs, leaders driving change in biotech, medtech, tech bio, and healthcare. The conversations inside our community, stories of conviction, navigating challenges, and making bold decisions inspire us every week. Now we're sharing them with the world. James, thank you for chatting with me on A Call to Lead today.
Thanks so much for the invitation, and I'm pleased to be here.
Now, James, you have a PhD. You're an academic by background. You got that at Imperial College London. But as well, and my background being kind of molecular microbiology and synthetic biology, I did note that you have been involved with iGEM, the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition for the Uninitiated. And you did that as an undergrad, as an advisor, and as a judge, not all at the same time.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you know, that for me, that kind of catapulted me into this world of synthetic biology, but also having the opportunity to conduct independent research as well. And you know, that really was the thing that gave me the bug for wanting to kind of carve out new research directions of my own, and ultimately ended up with me founding LabGenius and building the company that it is today.
That's the big question. You've kind of come from that background of academia and innovation, but leadership is a very different thing. So I'd love to know, what called you to lead?
I think for me personally, it even goes back before university. I grew up in a medical household. My mother trained as a nurse. My father's an orthopedic surgeon. And so, you know, helping people as part of what you do and how you think about the world was kind of ingrained in me from day zero. I think my dad always wanted me to be a doctor. And, you know, I was kind of almost considering that path until I must have been about, 14 or 16 years old. And he said, look, come along for work experience to the hospital. You'll learn what we medics kind of get up to. And I went with him to the hospital. And he'd been a bit disorganized that day. And so he just grabbed a colleague and said, look, can you supervise my son today? So I stepped into this room with his colleague. And I didn't realize it at the time. But he sort of sent me in with the expert in running colonoscopies. And 8 hours later, you know, I emerged from that room, you know, with just one absolute clear conviction, which was I did not want to be a doctor. That certainly cancelled out that route. But, you know, I think the thing that always has inspired me is the fact that, you know, if you're innovating at the cutting edge of biology and science, the scalability of those innovations really have the potential to impact millions of different people. And I've always had a deep love of biology and molecular biology. And, you know, that's the thing that kind of set me out on this route to going to Imperial, to learning the discipline of the subject matter. And ultimately set me on this path to build LabGenius.
Yeah. And how, this was your first time CEO kind of role. How long did it take for you to feel like a leader?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I almost feel like the leadership aspect is kind of like an incidental byproduct of just wanting to build something. You know, it's like you can't do it on your own. And so you have to kind of coalesce other people around you, team members, investors, partners, and a leadership is a kind of requirement of that. You know, as you say, this was not only my first CEO position, but it was actually my first job. And I kind of, you know, I founded the company whilst I was doing my PhD at a time when, you know, I would say probably I had more confidence and competence. And, you know, I think the last, maybe that's something that, you know, you always look back and say with the power of kind of hindsight. But over the last, you know, 12 years or so, the journey that I've been on really has been one about, I guess, learning about myself, learning about where my strengths are, where my gaps are, and bringing those around me who I've been fortunate enough to support the business over the years, and mentors who've helped me kind of get out of my own way and learn how to lead and bring others on the journey with me.
Yeah. Was there like a catalytic moment for you then during your PhD when you thought, you know, someone's got to do this and it's got to be me?
Yeah. I mean, I felt, you know, one of these moments when you just feel like, you know, you're in the right place at the right time and you can see how the future is going to look. And it feels so obvious to you. But when you take a step back, you realize it's only so obvious because you're there working at the coalface. And I felt like it was one of those moments when I was doing my PhD, because, you know, on the one hand, we all have family members who, you know, are falling ill with diseases like cancer and getting treated for those diseases. And you can just see how inadequate they are. You know, you can really feel that. And then at the same time, you're going to work and, you know, you're the kind of work that you can do in the lab, you're operating at the convergence of all these disparate technologies that are moving so quickly, like gene sequencing, gene synthesis, robotic automation, molecular biology, synthetic biology. And you think, wow, you know, on the one hand, the treatments that patients are receiving today are so inadequate. On the other hand, the rate of research and innovation has never been faster. And so it felt like there was a real opportunity there. But at the same time, I was confronted with this kind of challenge by the fact that every time that I tried to use my brain to design new biological systems, nothing ever worked. And it was that kind of realization that human cognition can only take you so far. But with the advent of all these disparate technologies, maybe there was an opportunity to stitch them together in such a way that you didn't have to rely on the limits of human cognition to make cool stuff. And you know, I think when you kind of maybe open the aperture of kind of like scientific innovation and the possibility of this approach for humankind, like, I think we'll look back at this moment in time and say, that was the moment when the whole of scientific innovation changed, the whole of the way in which we do research changed, as we start to build these kind of semi-autonomous systems that can design experiments, run experiments, learn from what they've found. So yeah, I feel like you and I are so lucky to be in the field at this moment in time, but we're in the eye of the storm. And I think it'll be only a few years from now when we look back retrospectively and we can say, wow, wasn't that a wild moment?
I'm sure it is rapidly changing since I left the lab kind of 5-10 years ago. I don't think I'd recognize the inside of a lab now. I want to go back on something you just said, where, because you grew up in this household where, you know, your parents were medics and you've got this value of intrinsic value of helping people. But you also touched on something there that's very common in our membership among the other life science founders, which is that there's family members getting sick. Could you expand on that thinking a little bit, how it influenced you?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it's one of those things where, you know, you read the statistics and, you know, sort of like most of us at some point in our lives, you know, we'll get a disease like cancer and the outcomes are pretty clear. But it's only when you sit down with a family member and, you know, we've had multiple, you know, as most people have in their personal lives, you sit down with them, you watch them go through, you know, receiving chemotherapy, the effects of chemotherapy, the kind of the slow and steady degradation of their faculties. And you realize just how prehistoric some of these treatments are that we give to people. And that's no fault of the clinicians. It's more kind of, I guess, representative of the fact that a lot of these therapies were developed a long, long time ago when the technologies that we had at our disposal were so very different from the technologies that we have today. And so we know what we have to do. We know these treatments have to be more targeted. They have to be safer. They have to have broader therapeutic windows. They have to be resistant to the emergence of resistance. We know exactly what we have to do. It's just a case of bringing together the disparate technologies that will allow us to do it. And so, you know, I've almost working at that interface of those technologies, I mean, you actually feel an obligation. How could you not work on this problem? How could you look yourself in the mirror and say, like, look, I'm going to go and I don't know, join a bank, not to discredit any of my colleagues who joined banks or a consultancy or whatever it was. But, you know, when you are operating in this space, I think you actually have an obligation to, or a certain kind of like a moral obligation to at least ask yourself the question, what can you be doing to help? Because, you know, it's not just the relatives and the people around you who you know and met and who have suffered from this, but it's all those folks who are just getting their diagnoses today or last year or next year. And you know, one of the things that is most poignant for myself is, you know, we regularly receive emails from people all around the world who say, like, I saw Lab Genius's labs on CNN or on this other TV channel or whatever it is. Can I try your therapeutic? Or it's like, it's my dad or it's my brother or it's my son. And you know that, you know, there are people who out there who need this now. You know, this isn't kind of like a theoretical exercise. It's nothing, you know, this is real. These are real people. And you know that no matter how fast you move, you know, the reality is that you're not going to be able to help those people. But maybe those who come after them, those who are receiving their first diagnoses today, maybe you do have a shot at helping those people. So, you know, I think it's moments like that that give you the moral imperative and the incentive to kind of wake up every morning and be like, guys, we have to move faster. We have to move faster.
Yeah. No, I can really feel that. On your leadership journey so far, the moral imperative has clearly been a driving force. But again, as a first-time CEO, you must have faced a lot of obstacles and challenges on a personal level. Are there any that come to mind, and how did you overcome them?
Yeah, I think, you know, the whole journey has not been an easy one. And, you know, I think the brilliant thing about communities like this is you realize that, you know, from the outside, everyone's kind of like posting success stories on their social media. But when you sit down, you know, and have a couple of drinks with somebody, you realize that you know, everyone is grinding away, and every company, you know, reaches these moments of kind of existential crisis. And I think that's the reality of it. You know, it's not a kind of glamorous conference circuit and just kind of telling investors where to wire the money to. It's you know, a lot of people working really hard, really long hours late at night to kind of break new scientific ground to get the science to work. Because I think, you know, and the thing that everybody learns when they're doing their PhD is like the science default doesn't work and you have to force it into existence. You know, I think that's the reality of it. And not only that, but you're operating in this like massively ambiguous space where, you know, if you're a traditional SaaS company, all you have to kind of care about is revenue moving up and to the right. You know, here it's a lot murkier. It's a lot more ambiguous. You're kind of a lot more susceptible to the changing shifts of sentiment in the global macroeconomic climate. But I think one thing that we do have is that kind of North Star of knowing that if we're successful, even though, you know, the probability of any of these therapies working is vanishingly small, but if we're successful, the impact that it could have is the thing that will make it all worth it. So, you know, I think at every stage we face a lot of challenges, but I think the only reason that we've kind of stuck at it, and I think the same is true for a lot of teams in biotechs, is because of that purpose and that drive.
And on the more personal level, has there been a challenge that you had to face down? Or has there ever been a moment where you felt, I can't do this?
I mean, I think one thing to say is when you embark on a journey like this, and you know, anyone who's built something will kind of viscerally feel this. It's not just like you who's doing it. It's your whole family. So you need the support of you know, your loved ones, your parents, your children. In our case, you know, my wife is very patient, and she said, yeah, James, absolutely go for it. Kind of, you know, really kind of swing for the fences and try and live your dream. But then when we had our daughter, and, you know, we were expecting our first child, she said, yeah, okay, you need to start drawing a salary now, and you've got until our first child is born And if you haven't started earning a salary, then, you know, I'm really sorry, but you have to get a real job. So that was kind of like a, that was like the first kind of, you know, I was kind of always like, I guess the equivalent of like your runway end date or whatever it was. It's this kind of like very finite moment in time where you have to get the thing off the ground. And, you know, when we were, when we first started, I mean, you knew the company back in those days, just the days that, you know, those early days at Imperial. I had the luxury of being a PhD student, so I didn't have to pay myself a salary. You know, there's just a small group of us around and we got a tiny amount of angel investment, and that had started to run low. And I said, hey guys, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I'm cutting everyone's wages to below minimum wage. And, you know, 2 years yet later, you know, everyone was still kind of like below minimum wage. It was one of these kind of real crunch points. We did get the round together. I closed it from the hospital car park shortly after my daughter was born. But it felt like one of those like absolute moments of, you know, it could have gone one way or the other. We got it just done. And I think the rest is history. But, you know, I think the thing that is a great relief to me is that's kind of par for the course. And when you speak to every CEO of a biotech company, it's kind of like just getting used to living in that ambiguity is part of the job.
You mentioned that you had employees working on very little during a particularly difficult time for the company. How did you inspire them to stay with you through that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. You know, this was right at the company's beginning. And, you know, I think the reality here, we were a group of very close-knit friends. We'd all done our, you know, research together on the benches next to each other. And it didn't seem strange at the time. It was just a case of, you know, guys, look, we all earn exactly the same amount of money, which is nothing. We now even have less money. So we're going to just each get a smaller fraction of nothing. And I think, you know, maybe this is like an advantage that you have when you're just starting the business from scratch, which is the first few people that you need to join you on this journey are those who you have a deep personal trust-based relationship. They're here really to kind of build things from the ground up. And it helps if you have those kind of deep trust-based relationships, you know, in existence already. I think if you're hiring in somebody who you've never met before and you've never known before, you can't really expect them to kind of go home to their families and say, hey, look, I've just got hired into this job. But it turns out that the CEO now says I've got to spend the next 2 years on less than it's, you know, gonna cost me to just survive. So I think this is an interesting reflection really around how the composition of teams change over the course of a new venture. Now, if you're capitalized with 100 mil from the get-go, you can obviously build your company one way. But if literally you kind of are starting a company out of a PhD with no resources whatsoever, then really the only way that that is even theoretically possible is to have these folks around you who will go to the ends of the earth with you and, you know, work through these kind of long nights just to get the thing off the ground.
Yeah, it sounds like you had a very big trust and value-based relationship with these people.
And it is absolutely true to say that the business would not exist without them.
And you've touched on like the difference between what we present on social media versus what we say behind closed doors, where, you know, having a coffee with your peers or even talking in a community, a safe space for CEOs like Life Science Org, the conversations are very different to those that are publicly had at conferences and on conference stages anyway, and LinkedIn pages. But what you've kind of touched on it, but I'd like to hear what maybe is the biggest challenge that you share with your peers today?
Yeah, you know what? I find like a lot of the time, everybody knows exactly what they have to do, whether it's to raise money, to deliver certain results, et cetera. The hardest thing, at least it has been for me, is how do you bring that organizational alignment to so that you can, I guess, you know, work within the context of a team to deliver, you know, whatever it is the company needs. And I think the reason that's fundamentally quite a challenging thing is so many of us come from academia where the kind of the default way of working is, you know, you kind of go off into a lab, you kind of work on your project, you make progress, you share the progress. But working in a kind of a biotech setting is just so different. And you need a completely different set of tools and techniques and approaches to achieve that. And, you know, I think where my learning has been steepest and most valuable is where I've had the mentorship, especially from our chairman, Edwin Moses, around what are the types of tools and techniques that I can use to create that organizational alignment. So a lot of the time when I'm speaking with other biotech CEOs, like, it's always the same pain points that come up. It's like, how do I drive organizational alignment? How can I focus my team on the things that are going to create value? And how can I deliver in this kind of highly ambiguous, challenging environment? So I think, yeah, it's the tactical stuff that I find kind of like very valuable and helpful in those conversations.
Yeah. And you've mentioned Edwin Moses, who's been in Life Science Org as well. I've had the pleasure of chatting with him a couple of times. He's an amazing mentor to have. This kind of leads on to my next question for you, which is there a valuable lesson that you've learned from a colleague or a peer, or maybe Edwin himself, that no formal education could possibly have taught you?
Mm. Yeah, I think just watching the way in which folks who have more experience and more muscle memory than you handle situations is probably like the most valuable thing. I've been in situations where I felt that the situation was kind of uniquely painful. And then I'll just, you know, you kind of get your confidence together, you phone up your board member and you say, hey, I've got to communicate this bit of information to you. And you know, they'll just be like, yeah, I've heard the same thing three times over the last month from other CEOs. This is not new. This is just like standard. And so I think just watching, you know, I think especially as a first time CEO, kind of overanalyze everything, you can get trapped in your head. And it can cause a lot of kind of anxiety. And I think, you know, probably the most helpful thing is sitting down either with someone in your management team, an advisor or a board member, and just being able to have that kind of transparent, open conversation. Because whatever challenges it is that you're facing, they've probably seen it before and they know how best to navigate it. Actually, probably the bit of advice that was most helpful to me was actually a bit of advice given to me by a wonderful lady called Vidya, who runs our lab ops here at Lab Genius. And she said, nothing is ever as good or as bad as it seems. And that's the kind of thing I try and remember in any of these situations, because, you know, the startup journey, it's a roller coaster, so many highs, so many lows. And at those moments, you know, you can get a bit carried away. And I just try and, you know, channel Vidya in those moments and just think nothing is ever as good or as bad as it seems.
That's definitely a wise sentiment. And I like how your uniquely painful experience was something that someone had heard several times.
Yeah, and you know, I think the other side of it is, like, I've been fortunate enough to back a few teams in Europe through making angel investments. And similarly, you know, I'll have calls with those CEOs and, you know, they'll say like, hey, James, I just need this piece of advice on this situation. And, you know, it feels to them at that moment, as it did to me, like the world is like caving in on them because they're trying to deal with something for the first time. But, you know, the reality is nothing's ever new and everyone's dealt with these challenges before.
You still get that feeling, that still unique pain occasionally, that little bit of anxiety.
You know what? I think one thing that I have learned is that the more pain that you go through, the bigger your tolerance becomes. And I feel like it's almost like you're constantly being emotionally stretched as a CEO, and you've got to, you know, it's painful, but you've got to go through that, because by going through that, then everything afterwards just seems like you're much better equipped to deal with it. And I think that's where, you know, having seasoned folks around you who, you know, for whom this isn't their first rodeo, who have been through various boom and bust cycles, and they know just like, ignore all the noise, keep your head down, keep focusing on delivering the results, keep the team focused, keep the team, you know, optimistic. Those are the only things that really matter.
You heard it here first, everybody. This is a nugget of wisdom from James himself. And if I hear this in a future podcast that someone says, well, I heard James Field say this.
Well, I probably stole it from our chairman. So, you know, I think that's the credit where credit's due.
Even better. Before we talk about Lab Genius, I would like to know, because you've done iGEM, which is, I guess it happens in Europe and the States as well. They alternate. But you got to see a fair bit of international science in that time. And you kind of get to see what the world is like in terms of life science. So I'd love to know, what do you find particularly exciting or inspiring about European life science for leaders like yourself?
Yeah, I mean, really interesting question. And I think this is a question that the whole of Europe is actually asking itself right now, right? Because the broader context here is, you know, especially in biotech, there's a meteoric rise of Asian biotech companies, especially in China. And man, they are hungry. They've got great science now, super hungry. They're working, you know, all hours every day. And credit where credit due is credit due. They've done it, you know, an incredible job. I mean, on the other side of, you know, the ocean, you've got, you know, a lot of these American teams, very well financed, again, exceptionally competitive, working very hard, good science. And you know, so where does that leave Europe? And I went to a conference recently, and the panelists, who, you know, really prestigious group of panelists, got asked, so, you know, how you got, you know, in Asia, you've got all these incredibly hardworking teams working all hours of every day. In America, you've got all of this money. How does Europe compete? And, you know, actually, I hate to say this, but the panelists were stumped. And I think, you know, the candid situation is a lot of European teams are asking themselves that question right now, which is like, how do we compete? Like, who are we? And, you know, are we a more aligned to Asia, or are we more aligned to US? But I think for me, just like looking tactically and just from personal experience, a few of the areas that I think that Europe is uniquely positioned to really take advantage of is number one, just kind of the breadth of thinking here. So a lot of the time, like the way in which education is structured in Europe is you go very broad before you go very deep. So, you know, before folks have specialized, it's often the case that they have gone, you know, exceptionally broad across their studies. And I think that's helpful when it comes to then thinking as a kind of mature scientist or engineer, when you're kind of trying to draw a lot of disparate ideas together, because the magic often happens at the interface. I think the other piece here is, obviously, we've got, you know, really good deep academic science to draw on, but you know, maybe like slightly more controversially, the near-term benefit that we're facing is Europe is an exceptionally good home for talent. Partly because of cultural reasons, partly because we're just not the US. We've seen a large exodus of people from the US who have some connection to either the UK or Europe, want to return back to Europe because of the current political situation. You've got all of the issues at the FDA and the NIH. And suddenly Europe starts to look like an exceptionally attractive and stable place to do good long-term science. So I think near-term, you know, it's incumbent on all our politicians and policymakers to make sure that Europe remains an amazing place to relocate to. And then I think, you know, it's also incumbent on us as Europeans to really kind of crystallize and distill down how we remain as competitive as we can be in an increasingly challenged global economic environment.
Yeah, that's very well put. I think the next few years are going to be very interesting for European science to see what comes in and who comes in and what are we going to do with it?
Precisely.
Given everything we've talked about until now, your personal journey, the challenges you face, the challenges we all face in life science in Europe in particular. Tell me now about Lab Genius. What is the unmet need that you set out to meet? And why is now the time under your leadership?
So I think the core problem that we're trying to address really comes down to that kind of visceral experience that I had when I was doing my PhD, which was, I was trying to design new molecules, and as a human protein engineer, I just couldn't get any of them to work. And the reality is, it's because, you know, my brain didn't evolve to design molecules at the nanoscale. I think the opportunity that we have is being able to knit together these disparate technologies to create systems that can grapple with that kind of level of complexity. And when you can do that, you can start to deliver molecules that go beyond the limits of human intuition and understanding. And I think that's really key for me, because when you look at, you know, as I mentioned, conditions like cancer, there is such a big gap between what we need and what we can make as humans that we have to find a way to address it. And I think these kind of semi-autonomous smart robotic platforms are the way in which we can do it. So at Lab Genius, what we've done is we've really built one of these kind of complex discovery engines that combines high throughput experimentation to machine learning to create this next generation of therapeutic antibodies. And for our internal pipeline, what we've really done is focus down on this issue of on-target off-tumor toxicity. So, you know, actually the premise here is very, very simple. Just as on a computer, you might use sort of control F to find something and then delete the thing that you want to delete. We're trying to build the same thing into a therapeutic molecule. It's got to be able to sample multiple healthy cells, sample multiple disease cells, make a decision over which is healthy, which is diseased, and then very selectively kill the disease cell. Sounds very simple, but from a molecular engineering perspective, it's a real challenge because what you have to engineer these molecules to do is to take multiple different inputs, have some kind of processing mechanism, and then an actuator to kill your target cell. And you can only do this if you can start to engineer these molecules and program them as you would start to program, say, computational systems. So it's an order of magnitude more complex compared to what, you know, you might try to do through rational design. So I think whilst it's a challenging problem to solve, the time is absolutely now because we have at our disposal, or starting to have at our disposal, all of these different tools and techniques to grapple with that complexity. And this speaks to this kind of mega trend of the digitization of biology and everything that will come from that. So I'm exceptionally bullish as to why now is the moment where, you know, we should be leaning into these really challenging but potentially very high impact problems.
And is this really reflective of that dream when you started out?
I think it's in response to this kind of irk I felt of like, look, these are hard problems to solve. I'm not the best protein engineer, but what happens if the very best protein engineer or best protein engineers collectively can't solve it? We need systematic approaches as a species to grapple with this kind of complexity. Otherwise, you know, we'll hit this kind of glass ceiling in terms of the limits of innovation. And at its core, that's what I'm really interested in tackling.
Yeah. And getting very positive, which is not what we're used to, I think, in European life science, but getting very positive and imagining that everything does go well, that everything works out, you get the funding you need, the results come in. I want you to imagine looking back at your successful career. How do you hope to be remembered as a leader?
I think for me, actually, it's less about like, if I wasn't remembered at all, I think that's actually probably a very good thing. I think I'd love it if the business was remembered for what it delivered, rather than, you know, myself or anyone else. And really, I think that is the mark of a successful institution, ultimately, because, you know, I'm not trying to build a company that will develop one drug and flip it and that's the end of the company. What I'm really trying to do here is build something that could one day become one of these institutions where it's a smart robotic platform that can continuously learn, continuously improve the complexity of the molecules that it can make. And that, having an organization that stands on its own two feet, irrespective of who's at the helm, that for me is really the kind of the true sign of success.
Yeah. Paint a little picture for me. What does the world look like because of your success?
Yeah. I mean, I think if it is the case that we can genuinely systemize the discovery of molecules with exquisite selectivity, then we have an engine where we can start to address all types of different solid tumors with solutions that would have gone well beyond the limits of human understanding in terms of what one would have been able to create through traditional rational design. And if you take that to its nth degree, you can imagine a world, you know, in the distant future where you're a cancer patient, you go in, you get your cancer sequenced, systematically you get cooked up for you a highly targeted, highly safe treatment that's customized to your individual cancer, and then are treated, you know, really, really quickly. Because the way in which, you know, we've historically done it, said, okay, this person's got breast cancer, lung cancer, ovarian cancer, you know, it's so crude. And, even now, we're just beginning to kind of categorize these into, oh, it's a cancer with the following sets of receptors that are upregulated. But the reality is every cancer is unique. And so you take that to its nth degree, you know, ultimately to get the best outcome for a patient, you need a personalized treatment.
Yeah. Every cancer being unique, every patient being unique, it is certainly the way that medicine is going. James, I want to thank you so much for your time. However, I always have one last question. And this is your podcast. So I would like to know, what would you like to discuss in your last few minutes that we haven't discussed?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say, like, thinking of leadership, how is it that leaders should operate in an environment that is a financially challenging one? And the context here is as follows, which is, you know, we've rapidly progressed from the kind of the zero interest rate world where a lot of companies were under pressure to kind of grow as fast as you can, deploy capital as fast as you can. And the pendulum has very much kind of swung the other way now. It's all about, you know, you've got to maintain capital efficiency. You've got to be as lean and mean as possible. And I think that creates a very different operating environment within a business. But how do you maintain that kind of capital efficiency whilst also building for the future? And the reason that I think that's a challenging topic to grapple with, and I don't necessarily have the answers, is that you've got a lot of different time frames you have to consider there, in the sense that if I'm an investor investing in a company, I may only be interested in how does the capital I'm deploying enable the company to raise at a higher valuation at their next financing round. But in contrast, if I'm a member of the management team or a CEO, maybe, you know, the time frame that I'm thinking about is what happens over the next kind of 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And maybe I want to deploy that capital in a way that is going to create no short-term value, but is critical to the long-term survival of the company. So I think, you know, again, I don't necessarily have answers to those questions, but in a world which is increasingly capital constrained, I think those are the kinds of challenges that CEOs are increasingly having to grapple with. And there's like maybe less appetite for making some of those longer term bets. And so that creates a lot of kind of interesting implications and challenges for CEOs building businesses today.
It's certainly an interesting challenge to end on. Let the listeners think about that one. Maybe someone can write in. I don't know if we have a mail-in thing for a podcast, but thank you very much, James, for joining me today. I really appreciate you talking with me on A Call to Lead.
Thanks so much. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Everybody knows that Europe is a global leader in generating translational science. We also have world-class leadership talent. To hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of our science leaders, listen to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, available on all good podcasting platforms.